Welcome to episode 122 of Speaking of Mysteries. I'm Nancy Clare, and my guest for the podcast is Rachel Housel Hall, whose City of Saviors, the fourth in her Eloise Lou Norton series of mysteries, is being released tomorrow, August 8th, 2017. Beyond favorite authors, I think most crime fiction fans also have favorite places and times, whether they admit it or not. In the case of place, I can't get enough of Southern California-based mystery fiction, which in turn gives me a wide range of times. From the past, I'm a fan of Raymond Chandler, well, who isn't, Ross McDonald, McDonald's wife Margaret Millar, and Horace McCoy. From the present, really well-known writers such as Robert Craze, Michael Connelly, Kem Nunn, T. Jefferson Parker, and Don Winslow. And less well-known, but I would argue just as riveting mystery fiction scribes include Denise Hamilton, Naomi Hirahara, newcomer Joe Ide, and yes, Rachel Hall. L.A. and the greater Southern California area is a big place with lots of stories. Here's Rachel Housel Hall to talk about hers. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. This is Nancy Clare, and our guest for this podcast is Rachel Housel Hall, whose fourth Eloise Norton mystery is just about to be published. So first of all, congratulations on your next pub day, and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. I am so excited. It never gets old getting ready to have your baby published. I just got my box of books 2 days ago, and it was just like my first box of books. It was very exciting, and I can't believe that I get to do this.
Before we get started talking about the book, I want to mention that you are not, at least not yet, a full-time writer. You have a full-time job working at a nonprofit.
Yes, correct. It is a Pancreatic Cancer Action Network, and it is a full-time job.
And you
I am actually laid out on the couch right now because it is a full-time job. As I get older, I get more tired. So yeah.
And you have children. You have a child with all that entails of, you know, teams and school and all of that.
So, yes, a 13-year-old girl who is going to the 8th grade.
So you have your hands full, and yet you can you give the reading public your Eloise Norton series, and for that, on behalf of the whole reading public, I thank you.
Well, thank you for actually picking up the books and reading them and championing them, mine and so many other great writers who need that type of attention.
Well, you know that, first of all, you know I've been a fangirl, and I've been a little stalkerish with you, so, you know, that's okay.
No.
But
I enjoy you. I like you. We hit it off.
Let's talk about poor Eloise Norton, though. She's back on the job in City of Saviors, which is the name of the new book. And she, after almost getting killed in Trail of Echoes, and she still can't get no respect. But stubborn doesn't even begin to describe her. So before I ask where Lou is going, I'd like to ask, where did she come from?
Lou actually is, in some ways, a bolder, badder representation of me and where I grew up in Los Angeles, South Los Angeles, which I would say is about 7 miles west of downtown. It's predominantly Black. It's browning now, so it's becoming a mixed neighborhood. But it's a working class neighborhood that in literature really hasn't gotten any notice. Because she is working class, that means, you know, she has pulled herself up by her bootstraps in many ways. She's gone to college. She's battled her demons, including her father who left when she was very young, and a sister who disappeared and was murdered. And she wanted to come back to her neighborhood and be an avenger. And initially she wanted to be a lawyer, but she couldn't pass the bar. So she ended up becoming a police officer. and she is policing her childhood, where she grew up. So there's this constant kind of push-pull with policing the people that you know and having them look at you kind of side-eyes because you're authority, but you're also a girl who grew up in that apartment over there. So she's conflicted sometimes. She understands why people do the things they do, and especially in that neighborhood, but she gets frustrated with that. She wants progress, but she recognizes that there are forces unseen that prevent that from happening. But she, ultimately, she's an Angeleno. She has a group of girlfriends that she bounces off ideas with and drinks with and enjoys barbecue ribs with. She has troubled relationships because she is a woman. She, you know, she is not perfect. And she, I like her. I would have, like, Taco Tuesday with Boo at, you know, any time. Because she's very real. She's funny, but she's hard.
I would have Taco Tuesdays with her in a heartbeat.
Yes.
So the case in City of Saviors is a little bit different than mm-hmm. previous cases, and it starts out like it's going to be just a guy that died, and it's an old guy. He's a Vietnam vet and a hoarder. And he dies in his mm-hmm. recliner at home during a heat wave. Mm-hmm. But things don't add up. And we should mention that Lou is not just a police officer. She's actually a detective sergeant. She's pretty high up in the food chain at her precinct.
Right.
But this case was so much more. But what really got me, because of course I live in Los Angeles too, is some of the uniquely LA aspects. And one of the things you tackle in this is the gentrification of neighborhoods. In this case, the neighborhood around Crenshaw Boulevard, which I think you say is getting paler.
Yes. Yes, it is. I live about a mile away from the neighborhood where the story takes place. And again, it's predominantly Black. And actually my area, it's one of the richest African-American populations in the country. And because we have, like, really nice houses with a lot of land and the nice marine layer comes in and I have an orange tree, it's becoming very attractive to white families. I mean, it's a great location. And so every morning, like every weekend, I see more and more white families who are moving in because you can't beat it. But at the same time, that means that, you know, there are people who can't afford their homes anymore, who have been here for a long time. But now that, you know, property taxes have increased, they can't afford it. So a lot of times these homes go into disrepair. And a lot of times there are old people who can't go anywhere else, can't do much. They're kind of forgotten in this block of McMansions and other teardowns. And that's who Eugene Washington is. He's an old guy in this, you know, slowly developing neighborhood who is kind of stuck there and who's kind of forgotten there. And in many ways, a lot of Angelenos, especially older and natives, are kind of being forgotten and built over because of the great property values, because of, you know, the large lots and the proximity to the airport and all that. So I wanted to tackle, you know, development and how wonderful it can be. Like for me, I'm excited because, yay, my property values are going up. But like I say in Land of Shadows, where are some of these people, where do they go? So while we're progressing, we are kind of leaving people behind. And we have, you know, self-appointed saviors. You have, you know, community organizations, you have churches, you have all these people trying to answer it, but it's a kind of hard answer to get to.
And also there's also temptation mm-hmm. To take advantage of the less of these exact people, and that's another factor that we'll talk to in a second.
But exactly.
I want to, your description of Eugene Washington's house, your descriptions, made me laugh and gave me nightmares. Lou telling herself that the crunching under her feet were pistachio shells, classic. Yeah. Not to mention the descriptions of the food that was next to Eugene's recliner and the herds of cats that were both living and deceased. So this is what makes the crime, if it is indeed a crime, and it does turn out to be one, but that's what makes it difficult for the SID, the Scientific Investigation Division, which is what it's called in Los Angeles, to investigate. Did you have to do a lot of research on hoarders and ew?
I did, because it's fascinating. Guess what people do in their homes, period. They don't even have to be hoarders, but, you know, it's like, I remember when we were looking for a house, and houses, when you're trying to sell them, ought to be spick and span. We go into houses and someone's burnt frying chicken and there's stuff on the ground. I mean, it's just horrible. So I can't even imagine, you know, an old guy who has, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder and no one's there kind of helping him and taking trash out. It was my imagination. The worst things that could happen to my house, I let rip. And then I love the show Hoarders. And I think part of the idea for this came when I was watching an episode. And it's fascinating to me. And every time I watch the show, I end up, like, cleaning up everything. Because the thought of just mess disturbs me. And for someone like Lou, who is kind of used to and celebrates order, this is probably, and someone who is suffering herself from not feeling well, this was one of the worst things for her to come back to, you know, coming off of leave, is this house that does this crazy in every single way. And I wanted that. I wanted to think, what is the worst situation I could put Lou in when she is not feeling her best? A hot day in L.A., in a house that has dead skeletons and roaches and all the rest of it. And, you know, I felt bad because I love her, but I needed to make her uncomfortable with everything. She's used to going into scenes, and, yeah, there's blood and spilled guts, but this is beyond even that. So it was fun and sad to put her in that house.
Well, you mentioned another thing that I notice is always part of your books, and that's weather. In Trail of Echoes, it was, you know, an uncharacteristically rainy period. In City of Saviors, it was the 1-2 punch of oppressive heat and the smoke and ash from fires. And weather's a constant in everyone's lives, but in your books, it seems to take a larger role. It sets the mood, and as you said, Lou is coming back from this horrible end. Not, it was a great ending, but the horrible things that happened to her at the end of the last book, and she's really shouldn't be back at work. But, and we'll talk about Lou as a person a little bit more. But she feels she must get back. She's driven. But I mean, is that part of what you go through? Like you wanted to do this hoarding house, and it had to be hot. You bring the weather in.
Yes.
It's almost like a character.
Yes, because it's L.A. I mean, we don't have true seasons. We have hot. Lately, you know, last winter we had rainy, but we have, you know, hot, fire, earthquake, fig alert. Those are, you know, those are how we talk about. Right now we are talking about the humidity and how strange it is. And yeah, we have fires, but my eyes aren't burning like they usually are in August. You know, it's the weather in Los Angeles and the lack thereof, and what we use as substitutes. that is the city, and it is a character, and it affects kind of everything we do. When it sprinkles, we don't like going out. You know, well, you live here, so you understand that, and how we put the in front of the highways. It's just one. It's heat, and it's the 405, and it's, you know, how to get one place from the other. And again, everything in Los Angeles tends to be extreme, and I like placing, you know, extreme weather in these books because in many ways, I mean, murder is the most extreme thing you can do. And for a homicide detective who's used to extremes in behavior, why not throw some extremes in Los Angeles type weather?
And I should mention that you're not exaggerating. The weather here, when it's bad, it's just, it's, when it's raining, you can't get from point A to point B. And yes, our freeways are so big in our imagination and in our landscape that they deserve their own article, the 405,
yes.
The 101.
The 91, the 405, and yeah, and then throw in weather. I remember when it was raining this past winter, I'd get on the freeway and it would be empty because people are just inside. We don't like driving in whatever that stuff is that's falling from the sky. And Lou is an Angelino through and through. So she fits right in.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about Lou. She's comfortable in her own skin, and I think it's fair to say that some, or maybe most, of her coworkers are not comfortable that she is so comfortable in her own skin. She faces a lot of, she got where she was by her own determination and her stubbornness and her work ethic, and that becomes part of how she reacts from people, especially people that she knows harbor this feeling that she somehow got preferential treatment as an African-American woman in the Los Angeles Police Department.
Yes. And, you know, she is basically what women are going through right now. I mean, just what, today, the Justice Department announced that they're going to be investigating cases of reverse discrimination. And how ridiculous is that? But it's no surprise, especially to women and to people of color, that people think you're getting over. Somehow, you know, landing in these spots where everything's free and given to you and it's so easy. So she, you know, we came up with a term after some election stuff. She persisted. And if that means, you know, rubbing people the wrong way, that just means rubbing people the wrong way. You're going to have to get over it because I'm not going to change who I am, because who I am saved me and kept me sane in this field, in this world. So, yeah, a lot of people, there are men on the force who aren't comfortable with who they are, with who she is, but they will never be comfortable. They won't be comfortable with her. They wouldn't be comfortable with anyone else that looked like her or talked like her. So it's more relying on your character and what you know in order to survive a field or a job that constantly questions reasons why you're there.
Except for her partner. You would think that her partner, who's kind of a God squatting guy from Colorado Springs, white as the driven snow, is the one person that understands. They have a really great relationship. I think that's one of the most interesting aspects of the book, is this relationship, because it just seems very, very real.
Yeah. Well, he gets to see it up close. You know, a lot of people who, I would say, for instance, a lot of like white folks who live around people of color have a better understanding of the struggle. Those, like, I have a few friends, white women, who have biracial children, and they didn't get it until they had that child to understand what people of color go through. And I would say Colin is front seat with this. They are partners, and he's seen and appreciated how hard she works and her ethic and her patience with him. And he is open to learning now. There are moments in City of Saviors where he doesn't understand why she's not doing what Lou would typically do, but he's not he's not thinking about Lou ever being weak like that. So some of her behavior, her new behavior in City of Saviors, kind of throws him off some. There are scenes when they're talking about Pepe, and he's kind of gobsmacked that her reaction isn't what, you know, what would Lou do? Well, you're not doing what Lou would do. Well, Lou has changed in some ways. Lou's tired in some ways.
And Lou is definitely hurt physically and emotionally.
Yeah.
She is seeing somebody. She has, it's part of the LAPD policy that in the wake of the what happened at the end of the previous book, that she sees somebody, and she's both resistant, but she's a very smart woman, so she understands that this is something she has to do. But you mentioned something that made me think. One of the most interesting interactions in this book was when they encounter the religious organization that Eugene was involved in. And and you would think it would have been an opposite reaction, but Lou is very ambiguous towards organized religion. A lot of it had to do with what happened when her sister disappeared and the reaction that she and her mother got at that time. Colin, on the other hand, is very enthusiastic, maybe more or less because of the pastor's wife, but I thought that was very, very interesting and a counterintuitive position that Lou would take. And I was wondering if you'd like to talk about the role of the church and faith in the community that you just described, this Crenshaw.
Right. Yeah. Well, and it's weird because part of it stems from my own fascination. I'm a person of faith, but I'm also a reader, and I am fascinated, for instance, with Jim Jones and People's Temple and what happened. And I just finished the book by Jeff Gwynn, The Road to Jonestown. And this is like my seventh or eighth book that I've read on it because, you know, we all, African-Americans, we have, you know, a very faith-based tradition, and even secular events in some ways turn into church. I mean, it's a weird thing that we have with church. And I think a lot of people who are not godly put themselves in that position and take advantage of our faith. And right now there's, you know, this whole prosperity message where they're big congregations who have to, in real life, they have to turn in tax forms and they're supposed to tithe this much and the pastor is in a Bentley. You know, it's a weird, and it makes me mad, actually. And if it makes me mad, it certainly makes Lou mad, who sees her community that is still suffering despite there being churches on every corner. And again, like you mentioned, she does have a bad taste in her mouth from how the church failed to help her and her mom. So coming and seeing this poor vet who's, you know, found dead in his hoarded house and knowing that he's a part of a church family, it's like, well, what was the point of him being part of a church family if they're not helping him? They're taking money, but they're not helping him. They're not tending to his soul. Whereas Colin, you know, Colorado Springs is, you know, Jesus Camp USA. So he's used to, you know, faith-based things and very happy when he sees something that reminds him of home. Church reminds him of home and the good memories he has with his family. So he's a little reluctant to look askance at the church, but, you know, Lou, the person who you think would be all up in the pews thankful and singing hymns, she's the one who's kind of looking cockeyed at the entire thing.
Well, it seemed,
and that was actually a little hard for me because I didn't want to, you know, put out there that I'm, you know, a godless heathen or anything, but I am reluctant of some parts of faith that are out there now.
I think Lou is very protective of her community, and of the people that inhabit it, as you said. And I think the name of this book is very, very interesting because it does bring in this idea of faith and the city of saviors and who is going to be the savior of Eugene Washington and the other men and women like him. Is it Lou and her and the LAPD? It doesn't seem like that's really possible. Or is it the faith-based organizations that they turn to? And that's, I think, what you one of the things that you examine in the book while you tell this ripping good story. There is, you know, always in your books, there is a look at something else, whether it's the parks or the schools or what kind of support in your previous book, young women get at school and how easy it is for them to be throwaways, that's one of the things that Lou is always looking at, you know, that she doesn't want anyone in her community to be a throwaway.
Right. Because, you know, we can all be that person. We can all be victims. And in many ways, you know, City of Saviors also refers to Lou's her own state. Who is going to save her? She is going through her own kind of personal turmoil. Yeah, she's alive, but barely in some ways. And she needs saving herself. And will her friends do that? Will Sam do that? Will Greg do that? Her mom wants, you know, and thinks the worst is happening. But, you know, she needs rescuing herself. So, yeah, I kind of like doing that. I talk about the city and community, but then I like putting her as a part of that thing that needs healing, that needs rescuing, that needs solving in some ways.
Well, you anticipated my question, my next question, which is, you know, her work isn't complicated enough, and her family and friends and lovers, and you've just mentioned most of them, both in case of her lovers, both her ex-lovers, like her ex-husband, and at least Lou hopes the potential lovers, they're all piling it on, and it's almost as if she's got this Job-esque life that she has to, if it's not happening at work, it's happening in her personal life. And she's really, I feel throughout this whole story, she is on the edge of, you know, she's close to breaking. And, you know, that of course brings, I'd like you to talk about that. And then think about what's next for Lou, and if you can talk about that in your next book, because I'm hoping there's a next book.
Well, I'm hoping there's a next book. I haven't written it yet, but I have, you know, thoughts about where she could go. But the great thing is, you know, with Los Angeles and with crime and with women, there are so many places you can go. But I did want to have her broken, because I know in certain points of my life, I didn't feel so strong. I always say this about some of women like us, like Lou, like you. We're like ducks, where we're gliding across a pond and it looks so smooth, but our little feet are working furiously to keep us, you know, floating. And in some ways, I feel that all the time, and I wanted Lou to feel that, where it looks so easy, but eventually she can't keep paddling. You're just going to have to stop. And, you know, these injuries that she's suffering, they're making her stop. And she's finally kind of recognizing that she can't persist all the time. She needs to, like, take a time out. And it's hard, you know, it's hard kind of admitting, you know, us A-types, us overachievers, us women who just keep going and going and going, that we are tired and we can't solve it all and we don't know the answers and I just want to go to sleep and have some red wine and watch, you know, Netflix all day. And really, it's scary to admit that to yourself sometimes, but I needed to show that side of her. She can't be a superhuman cop. She you know, I didn't want to go down the regular trope of her being, you know, a drunk and off by herself, because, you know, that's a little hard to do when you have friends and mothers and boyfriends and exes kind of breathing down on you. But she could definitely feel defeated. And in many ways, you know, she shows that she's defeated, even if it's just, you know, by herself in a car where she just drops off to sleep because she just can't anymore.
Well, I'm honored that you included me in that group. So thank you for that.
You are, yes.
But I also wanted to talk, you're very active in Sisters in Crime. You're active in organizations. And I wanted to talk about being a writer, not just a woman writer, but a woman of color writing in the mystery community, and the efforts of organizations like Sisters in Crime, and you know, it's expanded now to the Mystery Writers of America to try to make the genre more inclusive. And you know, I think of you and Attica. You know, Walter Mosley may have been sort of like the first guy out there, but I think of you as pioneers. I really, really do. I have tremendous admiration for you. And I wondered if you wanted to comment on this. Do you think it's getting better? Do you think it's, you know, I try not to talk politics on the show, but the atmosphere, like you mentioned, this that the Justice Department's going to use its very limited resources to look into whether white college students are having a tough time. So, you know, in the case of the arts, in the case of specifically crime fiction, do you think it's getting better? You know, are you able to expand it?
Yeah, in some ways it is getting better. I mean, we have a few more writers of color, like Kelly Garrett, whose book will be published next week with mine, and she writes cozy mysteries. And there's Phyllis Flam. There are a few. So our numbers are growing, but geez, I mean, numbers meaning seven. So in some ways, yay, there are more of us, but our leap in terms of numbers is not a great one. And part of that is because we still need people to pick up our books and read them. You know, a publisher won't renew your contract if the numbers just aren't there. And that's hard, getting someone to say, oh, yes, you're African American. I see your picture on the back of the book. Maybe you will have something that's relevant for me, maybe not. So getting them to say, I'll give it a crack, that's the hard part. And everybody's going to say, well, it's hard for writers everywhere, but, you know, it's easier to get someone to read your book if you look like them or you're from where they're from, or if you have, you know, powerful friends saying, yes, pick up this book and read it and buy the next. So it's Sisters in Crime and Mystery Writers of America, yes, they are trying really, really hard to diversify the organization, to include us more in panel discussions and the like. But the book selling, that no one has cracked that yet. And I don't know how to fix that, except, you know, lots of promotion. I don't think many of us get promoted as much as our white counterparts. There are just some places that you will never kind of crack because it's just a regional thing. I don't know. I try very hard to get out to as many places as possible. I'm getting to go to Minnesota for the first time for a book tour. And I will be there August 27th or whatever that Sunday is. And then I'm going back to Minnetonka in November because, you know, it's not a place I've been. And, you know, there's not like a hub of black mystery writers in Minnesota. So I'm going to try and introduce that to those readers.
But there are, however, a lot of touring book readers in Minnesota. I think Minneapolis, yeah, right. Minneapolis has the highest per capita reading in America, something like that. It's Well, the long winters. Long winters, Rachel. I mean, what else? I mean, you can all, you know, you can binge Netflix only so much.
Well, like I said, I'm glad I'm going, but you know, that takes either your publisher saying, "Hey, we'll send you there," and they're doing that for one. But I'm like spending my own money to do the November thing because it's important that. You know, they're inviting me. I want to show that I'm interested in being there and getting to know the readers there. I want to introduce them to me, to my part of Los Angeles, and to be open to other writers of color who, you know, you may not, you know, understand our love of weather and freeways, but you can certainly appreciate bad relationships and work issues. So, you know, It's finding those commonalities, those things that tie us together as people.
Well, I think my last question is mostly because we're both in Los Angeles, because you're in Los Angeles, and because Lou is such an interesting character, I'm amazed that this is not becoming a Netflix show or an FX show or any of those. ABC.
I know. We're trying very hard. I have a very smart team of incredible women who have been trying to get this on screen, small and large. Great screenwriters like Keeley Smith, who wrote 10 Things I Hate About You and Legally Blonde. Maisha Clausen, who's now doing Claws. Joy Bryant, the actress, is just incredible and smart, and Taylor Latham at Escape Artist, who she loves the series. They all love the series, but it's, you know, once again, it's hard to convince viewers would get it. But I am hopeful because, for instance, Girls Trip, the movie with Queen Latifah and Jada Pinkett, it's killing it at the box office. And Wonder Woman is killing it at the box office. So maybe, you know, the rising tide is going to lift this boat and we'll eventually see Joy Bryant as Lou Norton on some channel somewhere. I'm praying. That is my prayer.
Well, you are a woman of faith, so I'm going to leave that in your hands. And I can just see Lou as this amazing character and her complicated life, because heaven knows she's got, you know, with the ex-husband. Anyway, I'm hopeful that the next book, I know you work full time, that the next book will be out sometime before I get too old to read.
Ha-ha. Well, my next book, I have two things that are going to be after City of Saviors. In September, a whole month after City of Saviors, I co-wrote a book shot with James Patterson, and that will be out September 8th. It's going to be a part of an anthology. It's called The Good Sister, and it's another L.A. story. And then January 2019 of my standalone, The End of All Things, which is an Agatha Christie kind of tribute of And Then There Were None. That will be out then, and I am working on those edits right now as we speak.
Because there's no rest for the weary.
No. But, you know, I take my rest in, you know, in July, and it's now August, so it's back to work. But I love it, though. I absolutely love writing and creating all these cool stories and introducing people to a city that I love so much.
Thank you so much for your time and for talking to me about Lou Norton and about the work that you do. And my fingers are crossed very hard that Lou will make it to the small screen. I just see her on Netflix. I don't know why.
I do too.
But I do.
I do too.
And you know, if not Netflix, then maybe HBO. HBO would be okay.
Netflix or HBO or Yes, I want to see her on any screen, and there are great stories to be told through her. So, and
I look forward to catching up with you at another conference or one of your signings or
yes,
something.
Definitely.
So thanks again.
Thank you so much for inviting me to do this.